Okay, welcome everyone to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is March 7th, 2017. I have a full agenda, so I want to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2170, the Ombudsman Bill. Cassie, could you please read us a summary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2170 establishes the Office of Oregon Ombudsman, consisting of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Residential Facilities Ombudsman, Foster Parent Ombudsman, Foster Child Ombudsman, and Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator. The bill specifies appointment procedures for the Office of Oregon Ombudsman and establishes duties for the Ombudsman, including administration, program coordination, contracting with advocates, and appointment of support staff. The bill specifies requirements for foster child and foster parent ombudsmen, including the provision of information regarding rights, investigation of complaints, collaboration with stakeholders, resource assistance, and establishes a hotline. The bill requires the foster child ombudsman and the foster parent ombudsman to report findings and recommendations of investigations to the foster child or foster parent. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Great. And we are fortunate to have Senator Sarah Gelser here kick off the hearing, and Don representing Representative Stark.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. Good morning. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Albany, Corvallis, Philomath, Millersburg, Tangent, and unincorporated areas in that region. I am very happy to be here today in support of House Bill 2170. I'm disappointed that my friend and partner in crime, Representative Stark, is unable to be here. He sends his apologies that Capitol CRUD is capturing all of us, it seems. But I really commend the work that the good representative and Don have done on this bill. For me, what is most important about this legislation is the idea of creating a sense of independence for an ombudsman for children and youth that are in foster care. An element of the bill is also looking at an ombudsman for foster parents as well. I know that part has been complicated, and Don is going to talk about the firewalls that are being built to ensure that there is not a conflict of interest between the ombudsman that's serving the foster youth and serving the foster families. But it is incredibly important that children and youth that are in care have a strong, independent voice that they can turn to when they are having problems, because they have many whose only allegiance is to the safety and well-being of that young person. Unfortunately, Oregon's rate of abuse in foster care is 68% higher than the national average. That means it's 168% of the national average. And kids that I have met over the last couple of years tell me stories that are devastating about the experiences that they have had while in care. Everything from not being able to access food, to being sexually assaulted, to being told that their sexual assaults are their fault because they have run away, to not being allowed to eat dinner at the table with everyone else in their family. And unfortunately, these youth, because of lack of funding in the Department of Human Services, can't always get a telephone call or return call from their caseworkers. And sometimes when they have pointed to the Foster Youth Bill of Rights and known that there is an ombudsman, they've been told those are just words on paper. So they really need an ombudsman that does not report directly to the Department of Human Services to be able to address their concerns. So I strongly support this legislation and would just urge all of us to do everything that we can in these conversations to keep children and youth at the absolute center of what we are talking about. Our kids in our child welfare system, whether they are at home or whether they are in care, are in one of the most dangerous situations in the country. We have a crisis right now around the safety of children and youth. This is part of it, but in every bill that you hear this session, please put these children and youth first. They deserve no less than that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for State Representative Dwayne Stark, House District 4, representing portions of Josephina and Jackson counties. You can tell I've picked up a little bit of the Capitol crud, but not quite as bad as Representative Stark, who I'm going to guess got a little bit of this from his own foster kids. and that's the irony of this morning's hearing. You love them, and they give back their love. The senator really set up the need for this legislation today, and I handed out kind of an organizational chart for y'all. And Fred Steele, who's the long-term care ombudsman, is here with us today to kind of walk you through a little bit of that. That is the crux of the amendments that we're working on to kind of restructure the bill and make it even better with the confidentialities and the firewalls that we've listened to a lot of the stakeholders and have been building and working on for the past 4 months. To make this bill the best that it can be. So I want to back up just a little bit on some of the things that the senator touched on. And for those of you who don't know, there is a current foster child ombudsman housed at DHS, and that ombudsman exists only in a budget note from 2013 when we created the Foster Children Bill of Rights. And by the way, that ombudsman is sitting in the back of the room today along with the Governor's Advocacy Office Administrator. And so if the members of this committee have specific questions about how that system works right now or some of the numbers and all that, they are happy to come up and be a resource and answer questions here today. But they didn't plan on doing any detailed testimony. And secondly, this bill, 2170, is not to say anything negative about the current system, because it's a different structure than what we're proposing here in this bill. It's not to say anything negative about the job performance of the current foster child ombudsman. It exists in a different management structure currently today than what we're proposing. In fact, last year, the foster child ombudsman handled around 235 cases. I mean, he's a busy guy. So we want to give him a different structure so that he can have some of the true functions that other states use for their foster child ombudsman. And we want to add a foster parent ombudsman to the mix so foster parents can have some of the same resources that the foster child ombudsman in other states have and foster parent ombudsman in other states have. So you have to ask the question, what is a true ombudsman? The U.S. Ombudsman Association defines the public sector ombudsman as, quote, an independent, impartial public official with authority and responsibility to investigate, informally address complaints about government actions, and when appropriate, make findings and recommendations and publish reports. So we don't really have that right now for foster children in Oregon. And as you know, Representative Stark, I believe Senator Gelser served on the governor's, we call it the strike force, but the External Advisory Committee on Child Safety and Substitute Care Independent Review. It was almost a year-long process digging deep into DHS and looking at some of the cracks in the system, some of the flaws that we need to fix to help make our foster care system the best that it can be. And one of the findings that the consultants found, and I'll quote directly from the report, youth participants in our review expressed confidence that the foster care ombudsman listens and believes in their concerns, and other review participants reported concerns that the ombudsman is located within DHS, potentially creating a conflict of interest and not being truly independent from DHS leadership influence. So that was really important to have that brought forward in the governor's report. So as for foster parents, recent reports tell us that they too are seeking a voice and seeking someone to turn to for help. And this morning we uploaded into OLIS a really important survey that the Jackson County Foster Parents Association brought to this committee in the interim in December during legislative days. And they did a statewide survey. And it's a really great survey, and one of the key findings that they found was that 70% of foster parents felt that they are only sometimes or never a valued member of the foster child's team. And there's a variety of reasons for that. They don't have the resources to get respite care. They don't get a call back from the caseworker. I mean, there's a million different things that they could name for you, and we've talked to them. over and over again, but they truly need places that they can turn to get resources, that they can ask for help in a variety of different situations. And all of them say they desperately want a foster parent ombudsman, that we've the folks that we've talked to. So an ombudsman for foster families and child welfare that are truly independent from the state agency is not a new idea. Many other states are already doing that. We turned to the National Conference of State Legislatures and did our homework, and we found about 8 other states that are doing it successfully and have done it for many other years. Many years, Colorado, Nebraska, independent, Indiana, Michigan, Tennessee, Alaska, and Washington State has done a fabulous job. A lot of these states have the governor appoint the ombudsman. Sometimes the legislature appoints this foster parent or foster child ombudsman. In fact, in Washington State, the Office of Family and Children Ombudsman answers to the governor, but they wanted so much separation, they moved to another city outside Olympia just to get that separation from the agency and the governor. So our legislation envisions joining forces with the current Oregon ombudsman that already exists, with the long-term care ombudsman, the residential facilities ombudsman, the public guardian office, and creating this Oregon Office of Ombudsman, where we're already finding success, where human services ombudsmen already are getting the services that vulnerable Oregonians so need. And Representative Stark asked me to introduce you to a couple of foster parent constituents who made the long drive up from Grants Pass this morning. They are loving foster parents, and they wanted to tell you why we have such a need for foster parents, Barb and Ryan Frazier. And Madam Chair, I wanted to have them come up next on your list, if that would be okay.
Thank you so much.
And Madam Chair, may I add one more piece as it, and this is Sarah Gelser again, as it relates to the structure. There were two things that happened in the development of this bill that, again, this is not a comment on the people that are involved in this. This is about the structure. But as we went to try to have the conversations about this, one of those initial conversations with the ombudsman, the idea was that the Child Welfare Office was going to come with them to that meeting. And if you have a structure that is completely independent, that should not happen. The ombudsman should never be coming with the department or with the Child Welfare Office. I had another meeting in which I was having a conversation with a fantastic person who's the new governor's advocacy office, which is an interesting thing because that the governor's advocacy office is not in the office of the governor. It is also in DHS and reports to the director of the Department of DHS. And they do some fantastic work, but it is not an external independent review. And I asked the question, what happens if you get to the end of the review, the constituent, whether it's DD or child welfare, and you uncover that there has been a significant problem, and this person might have a tort claim against the state. An advocate would tell someone that. What would you do? And the answer was, well, I'd have to go and talk to the director. So I think that is, you can't serve two, you can't serve two authorities. You have to either be serving the individual for whom you are advocating or the agency which employs you. And that is why it is incredibly important that an individual's supervision and pay is not directed by the agency for which the individual needs advocacy within.
Thank you. And as I understand it, you've made a lot of progress since the bill was submitted. There are no amendments yet, but you're getting close. 90%
yes,
of the way there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Any questions for this panel? We have several others coming up.
Can I ask a short
yes,
one?
Yes, please.
So I appreciate this chart here, Don. So what's the current state of this? Do all these positions, you don't have to be in detail, but do all these positions exist already, or are there any new positions? There was no fiscal on the bill, or either one of you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Nierman, currently all the positions exist there except for the foster child ombudsman is currently housed at DHS, and the foster parent ombudsman does not exist. So we would be moving the foster child ombudsman over from DHS with its current funding, and we would be creating the new position of foster child or foster parent ombudsman.
Good, thanks.
Mm-hmm. So one new staff person envisioned in this.
That's right.
There will be a fiscal. Okay. Thank you very much. All right, next up.
Thank you.
Ryan and Barb Frazier. And Lupe Rankin.
Yes.
Good
Thank you for coming from so far away.
Thank you.
Good morning. Little nervous.
No. Okay. We won't bite, I promise.
Okay. Barbara and I have been foster parents.
Can you say your name for the record?
Oh, sorry. Ryan and Barbara Frazier from Grants Pass. Barbara and I have been foster parents now for 3 years. We'd have the pleasure of having 18 amazing children in the 3 years come through our home. Those ranging from 24-hour stays to 3 to 6 months, one for a year, and then we had a sibling group of three for a year and a half. We currently have one foster child in our care. We've had her for just over 2 years. Drew was adopted from birth after being in state care for 20 months. Being a foster parent has been, sorry if I choke up. Being a foster parent has been one of the most amazing things I've ever done. Watching an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old grow and blossom is one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen.
There you go.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
I apologize. Thank you, sir.
No problem.
Watching the children when they first come into your home have this shell around them, be secluded, have their hair long, piercings, everything, and then watching them grow and develop into amazing men and women is something that you can't even explain. The only way that I can explain it is the beauty of watching a sunset while being on the ocean. It's the only way that I can explain what we do. Watching them go from being secluded and sheltered to enjoying school, playing sports, enjoying fishing, and just being a family. They're not afraid anymore. Currently, there's only one person with inside DHS that I trust, and that's my certifier. Caseworkers, if I have a problem, I'm calling my certifier. With the current bill, I believe and I know that it would be a huge asset because I'll have somebody else outside of DHS that I can trust. Certifiers have so much pressure put on them with all of their, not only just recruiting and retention, but fielding calls from foster parents because they can't get a hold of caseworkers and they can't get a hold of supervisors and they can't get the answers that we so desperately need. Way off track here. with the Ombudsman's bill, there was a staggering number. I attended a meeting at DHS, and a number was put up on a board, and everybody started clapping because there was a 14% retention rate within foster parents. And I kind of stood back and went, that isn't a good number for me. All the data is given to DHS with exit interviews, and you have a lot of foster parents that have been doing this for a long time that are wanting to leave and stop doing it, not because of children, because of the trust that we have within the system and the lack of support. And with having an ombudsman, this would be a huge support, and I really believe that retention rate would increase for all of these children that desperately need loving and safe homes in this time of crisis. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just want to give you a little bit of...
Could you just give your name again for the record?
Oh, sorry.
For people who are listening out there.
That's okay. Barbara Frazier. And I currently sit on the Josephine County Foster Parent Association Board. I've also been on several of the hiring committees at Child Welfare for certification for the newest supervisor position. Ryan's on the Grace Committee. We stay pretty active within the community, and we kind of pulled out and started working on those changes, doing things like being here today, because at this point we kind of are at a standstill and taking new children into our home because of the way that we have been treated within the DHS system. So having that ombudsman there to hear our voice, hear other foster parents' voice, and give us the support that we need, that's important to get through our time of need, is really important to us. So that's why we decided to come today. We broke down just a couple little incidences, and I'll go back to what one of the ladies said earlier. We had a couple of children in care over the summer whose mother continually was calling the police on us. They were a brand new placement, and she would call. She called so much that the police finally said, "I'm really sorry, but I had to come and I'll have a talk with her." But the problem that bothers me the most is that we were away and the first call came in on a Saturday. We came home Monday, picked up the children from respite, brought them back into our home, and DHS didn't show up until Wednesday. There wasn't a problem there. There was no abuse there. But the reality is there could have been, and no one was there to protect them. No one came to check on them. And then a lot of the different complaints that we get from all of our groups of people that we get together are just no return phone calls, no follow-up, being truthful, being respectful, treating us as a valued member of the team. Some of it is the biggest thing that we talk about is the delivery of the child. You know, we don't ever want to say that they're dropping off a pizza at our door, but that's kind of the way it's treated right now. No, they walk away, shut the door, that we don't know if they have allergies, how do they sleep through the night, what are they afraid of, do they need a nightlight? And then we have to wait 2 and 3 days to get a call back from the caseworker after they've been brought to the home. And, you know, my thought is you cared enough to bring them to me, but you didn't care enough to call in the morning and ask me, did they sleep through the night? Do you need anything? My last little thing is troop preparedness, and I think that this is extremely important and can help, and then the ombudsman will be there to support us. Through the foundations training that a foster parent child gets before they go into foster care. I went into the foundations training after 15 years of early childhood education. I've seen a lot. And there was nothing in there that prepared me what was for going to the reality of what was going to happen as being a foster parent. They don't tell you about visits 2 times a week or 4 times a week, depending on how many sets of parents are involved. Counseling, CASA appointments, home visits, attorneys, doctor's appointments, dentists, not to mention any sports or extracurricular activities that the children may have at school. That's a little overwhelming. And multiply that by 7 children, and some of them from different homes that go to different schools. When we get interviewed as foster parents in the beginning, you know, it's wanted for us to both have good jobs and to be able to support these children and have a home for them. They don't ask you, you know, do you have a 9-passenger car? We drove 3 cars for the first year to get these kids everywhere they needed to go. And on top of the fact that it's kind of two-parent working with 7 children just doesn't work. You have to have 1 stay-at-home parent in order to cover all of those needs, and that kind of changes your situation. And then, I'm sorry, I made really pretty notes. Talking about the stipend and the things that, you know, financial part of it. People think that foster parents are in it for the money. And I'm going back to where we had our 7 children just last year. We spent over $1,000 in food a month. That didn't include their clothes, their school supplies, their extracurriculars. Every month coming home with, I need a new band shirt and I need a new, all of that fun stuff. We don't want these children in our family to ever be treated different than our bio children. All of these kids get the same things. They go on the same trips to the same football games, same camping trips, everything that everybody else does. So basically, at this point, I see it myself as a full-time volunteer. We're paying our taxes to be a foster parent because that is just how it kind of lays out. And I feel like as a full-time volunteer, in every sense of the word, this is a labor of love for us. And I wouldn't change it for anything, but we need a voice and we need to be heard and we need someone for us to keep us grounded in our time of need. That's why I feel like we need the foster parent ombudsman, and our children need their ombudsman as well because they need someone to protect them at all costs. I really get tired of hearing it's what's in the best interest of the child when that's truly not where the system is in our county at this time. And I just will continue to fight and change as much as I need to. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. That's very beautifully stated from both of you. Thank you both for your service and for coming all the way here.
You're welcome
to share that with us. Any questions? Yes, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for coming today, and I think it's the work that you're doing is very valuable because we all care about our children, whether it's our own personal children or our foster children. And I hate hearing stories that our children are being neglected. And it's going to be through work like yourselves that you're doing in this ombudsman program that we can provide the really good service. We're all working hard, and I think, but some of these ideas need to be put into place. So please continue your work, and thank you for coming today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. If Lupe Rankin is here, and Brittany Hope. And I'll call up one other then. Both of them here?
How are you?
And then how about, and Jim Davis? Bring Jim Davis up.
I said to Jim, I'm just here for you, man. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I'm not on it.
Great, you can go ahead and start. Just start with your name for the record.
Chair Kenny-Guire, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brittany Hope, and thank you for having me today. I'm very appreciative of being able to be here and speak to you. I'm here to talk about House Bill 2170 and what it could mean for over 7,000 children in foster care at the state today. Over the last couple years, we've seen an increase in a need for representation and advocacy for kids in our state. We've seen so many scandals, so many injustices done towards the children of our state. In 2013, we had Senate Bill 123 passed. That was a bill regarding the Foster Care Ombudsman creation and the Foster Bill of Rights. The Foster Bill of Rights is a one-page document, and it lists very basic rights that every child should have, no matter who they are, foster care or not, but that we were seeing foster children often did not get. Among these rights includes a permanent family, to be taken care of, to be provided hygiene products, to be able to own your own possessions. The Foster Care Ombudsman, his purpose in working in the system and working for the state is to make sure that these rights aren't violated for kids, because we knew that even if we created a Foster Care Bill of Rights, if there's nothing backing behind it, that ultimately it would fail. By definition, an ombudsman is appointed by the government or by parliament, but with a significant degree of independence, who is charged with representing the interests of the public by investigating and addressing complaints of maladministration or violation of rights. Over the last several years, I've had to work with our current foster care ombudsman, Darren Mancuso, multiple times. Some situations that I were in were less about rights being violated and more about general injustices, and some were about my rights as a foster child being blatantly violated by care providers or by the state. The first four rights, four of the first nine rights listed on the Foster Care Bill of Rights under the section to have what every child needs are as follows: a permanent family, a home where I am part of the family and treated as such, a safe and appropriate sleeping arrangement and adequate space for my personal belongings, and to keep my belongings, including things I buy, gifts I receive, if I have to move or if I stay in my placement. A couple years ago, I had a foster parent steal upwards of $2,000 in my possessions from me, including property that I had purchased myself from working my first part-time job, gifts that I received from friends, items that I had received from the Independent Living Program of Washington County to help me work towards independence and being a healthy and successful adult, and also things that the state provided for me for school and for work. I took this issue to the Foster Care Ombudsman because it was a blatant violation of my rights. I did so with many people being involved, including a caseworker who didn't stand up for me, a caseworker's supervisor who was absent, and my personal advocate being completely uninvested. Darren, our Foster Care Ombudsman, did everything he could to see that this was taken care of in an appropriate way and that justice was served in whatever form that looked like. He set up meetings, there were conferences, there were, I'm sure, dozens and dozens of conversations that I didn't even know about, trying to figure out what could be done for me specifically, but also on a larger scale, what could be done about foster children losing their property to people who did not deserve it or have any right to it. Ultimately, there was a meeting, and they had decided that if foster children are having their belongings damaged or stolen, they can submit a claim to risk management, which is the same department the foster parents would submit a claim to if the foster child broke their TV or put a hole through the wall. I submitted that claim, and after several months of silence, I was told that my case was not being pursued and dropped. I never received any kind of compensation. I never received my belongings, some of which were completely irreplaceable, back. There was nothing, and there was no further consequences for this foster parent, but more importantly, there was no justice for me in the situation. By the time that decision had been made, it was really too late for me to take it to a small claims court, and being a 16-year-old, I was too scared to, as I couldn't bring my attorney to a small claims court. As for the rights regarding a permanent family and a safe place to sleep and a home, I sit in front of you today as a foster youth, still in care of the state, that communicates with the foster child ombudsman frequently about the struggles that I am facing and my needs that are not being met, also my foster child rights that are being blatantly violated. I spent the last 5 months homeless and transient without a permanent family or natural supports. I would like to be very clear in that I think that foster youth across the state, including myself, we are extremely lucky to have this person and to have this position made. I would also like to be very clear that I don't think there is any person better for this position than who we have now. But as a position, by definition, he cannot be an effective ombudsman because he doesn't have that significant degree of independence that I mentioned. He's essentially working for DHS. How can he effectively monitor and police a system that is sending him his paychecks? He can't.
Brittany, we have to go on because we've got three other bills. Okay. You've shared a lot of information for us. Is there something you want to say just to wrap up?
Yeah, the other portion of the foster parent ombudsman that is not about removing him is the foster parent ombudsman to be added. I understand that there will be a fiscal that goes with this and that that's something that many people might want to fight against, but right now foster parent retention is a very large cause of why children don't have homes in the state, and foster parents don't feel supported or cared for, and they cannot care for the children that they are charged with providing services for if they are not supported. By not providing supports to foster parents, we're further doing a disservice to the children that the child welfare system was created to serve.
Thank you. Thank you very much for
Madam
your
Chair,
testimony. Yes.
Can I ask one quick question?
Quick question. Yeah.
Did they continue to be foster parents, the people that removed your items?
No, they were. The foster home was shut down for other abuse and neglect and licensing issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's
thank
a relief.
You. Yes.
Thank you, and thank you for the Oregon Foster Youth Connect program that I think you work with that has brought a lot of young people your voices to hear. I was honored to work with them to bring that 2013 bill forward, and it's just great to see the progression of that was a good start, and yet we need more of a voice and more of an independent voice for foster youth as well as for foster parents. So thank you so much. I know we get to see you in the Capitol more often, so if you can try to give us your testimony really briefly, and then submit it for.
You bet.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis. I represent United Seniors of Oregon and the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, both state affiliates of the National Council on Aging, as well as the Governor's Commission on Senior Services and the Oregon Disability Commission. Our organizations have not taken a stand on HB 2170, but there are serious concerns and questions that are raised, particularly around the roles and responsibilities and independence of the long-term care ombudsman. Our groups have decades of history of support for the long-term care ombudsman, strong relationships in the senior and disability communities around the Older Americans Act and things such as that. This bill creates an office of ombudsman with an executive director. It has great intentions, especially for the wonderful things expansion of responsibilities for foster parents and foster children, and some good language around independence. But we have serious questions around the impact of the long-term care ombudsman. There will no longer be a public selection appointment process for the long-term care ombudsman. The executive director will appoint the long-term care ombudsman instead of the Oregon Senate. There seems to be some significant changes in roles and impact of the long-term care ombudsman. Since the long-term care ombudsman must answer the executive director, that puts into serious question about the independence of the long-term care ombudsman and causes questions around the Older Americans Act. It creates a residential facilities ombudsman position, which seems to take on some of the duties of the long-term care ombudsman, but still seems to be ill-defined. The senior and people with disabilities advocacy communities are going to be having some serious conversations around this legislation over the next few days and weeks. I advise and urge the committee to take very serious consideration of the impact on the long-term care ombudsman before you pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. I know that's part of why we don't have a full amendment, because I know those discussions have been ongoing. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you. So I have two other people who, John Mullen and Fred Steele. I know Lena Al-Husseini is in the audience. I'm not sure if you want to testify or if you're just here as a resource. Did you want to testify too?
Yes.
Very short. Come on up. So if you can all be very short, because we're
I
behind.
I will be very short. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. We don't have a position on this particular bill, but I wanted to provide some historical context, and I'm going to begin
It might not be short.
No, particularly if I go back to Genesis and say that Adam was given responsibility for naming things and Noah was given responsibility for gathering things two by two creatures. So we're naming and sorting creatures. The idea about rolling everything into a one ombudsman office does create some concerns that Mr. Davis talked about. There was a bill back in the 2011 session, Senate Bill 449, that we testified against because it put the responsibility for the rolling these ombudsman programs together and putting them under the legislative direction. We were concerned about the potential to politicize those offices. So the independence, of course, is very important, and I really very much want to commend Representative Stark and Senator Gelser for taking a lead on this issue, because from their testimony and testimony that follows, it's apparent that the real issue appears to be in the foster care area. For the very reasons that we don't put children foster care and adult foster care together, just because we call them foster care, I think I would just advise caution about whether it makes sense to roll all of these programs up and talk about having a program just generally for ombudsman. And finally, I would just say that I worked on the creation of the ombudsman program in the Oregon Health Authority when Healthy Kids was created, saying that we needed to have more of a focus on issues that might arise. The interesting thing about that position and looking at it is being embedded in the organization also gives that person access to information that may or may not be as forthcoming if the function is becomes independent. So I just would express cautions. Again, I don't have any particular concern about the bill, but the direction about where we go with naming and sorting and what we would like to accomplish, I think that one of the avenues that you might explore is solving the foster care issue, which seems to be the principal reason for having this bill.
Have you been a part of the discussions yet?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Fred.
Yeah, Chair Kenny-Geyer, early in the morning. Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Fred Steele. I'm the state long-term care ombudsman, which in our current structure it, makes me the director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Want to be quick, especially with your time, but in particular, want to be able to answer any questions that you may have from our office since this bill does propose a restructure of our office. But to just quickly touch on a couple points, for 28 years, from 1985 to 2013, our office existed as just the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. Organizations, senior organizations and advocates that Mr. Davis is a part of, probably Mr. Mullen, I would imagine, back in the 1980s, helped establish the program. It is an independent agency to provide independent advocacy. In 2013, the legislature expanded the office to cover what's now called a residential facility ombudsman program, to cover the, you know, provide the same ombudsman advocacy to individuals in residential facilities, individuals with developmental disabilities, individuals with mental health diagnoses. In 2014, the very next year, another growth of our program with the placement of the Oregon Public Guardian program, Oregon Public Guardian Conservative program, was placed in our office. So we now have those three programs. With this legislation, it does a few things. As has been discussed this morning, proposes what I think might be a natural progression. In many ways, I want to leave that up to the decision makers, you legislators, governor's office, if that is a natural progression and growth of this office. Issue within our office currently, and I'm looking forward to talking to Mr. Mullen about this afterwards, we actually have within our current structure of even just our three programs, we're in current violation of federal law with me supervising the Public Guardian program. And this is something that became more evident with the passage of federal law and CFR in particular that went into effect last July. And I can talk more about that maybe one-on-one meetings and discussions if we need to, unless there are any questions. But this amendment and kind of this colorful org chart, you know, really rough org chart proposal is an amendment that I appreciate Representative Stark and Don in his office and Senator Gelser to some degree having some conversations about what an alternative structure could do to address many of the concerns that Mr. Davis is bringing up too about the independence of the long-term care ombudsman and the other related concerns. This proposal would have these five programs, you know, our three existing programs, foster child ombudsman and proposed foster parent ombudsman, be what would otherwise be independent entities, but under an umbrella with an administrative overhead. So essentially an administrator, kind of your chief operating officer, chief financial officer type. But all of the policies and independence would be retained within those programs. The proposal, when we see the amendment to achieve that in one part, is to preserve, for example, a lot of the language for the long-term care ombudsman that existed for 28 years, including the governor appointment and the retention of the independence. So I could get into more detail. I'll try to stop there for the sake of time, but wanted to cover those points.
Thank you very much. Alina.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lina Al-Husseini, and I'm the Child Welfare Director at DHS. And regarding House Bill 2170, we have no position. We just support whatever allows the voices of our foster children and our foster families to be heard, whatever addresses their concerns and what is in their best interest. So that's where we are on this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions? Nope. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Sounds like a little more work to do and a few more voices at the table, but we look forward to hearing the amendment. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2170, open a public hearing on House Bill 2347. We've got Philip Kennedy Wong, Janet Bauer, and is there anyone from DHS, Jill Gray? Anyone from DHS to talk about that? I think it's Jill Gray. Come on up while Cassie reads the summary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2347 extends the sunset to 2019, authorizing Department of Human Services to offer resources to individuals eligible for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, including employability assessment and orientation process for job opportunity and basic skills programs. And require a single parent of child under 2 years of age to participate in job opportunity and basic skills program, to deny request of recipient in TANF program to enroll in educational institution as an allowable work activity if the recipient was not enrolled in an educational institution, to disqualify recipient from receiving TANF program benefits for 120 days if recipient separates from employment without good cause, and to establish for the TANF program an income limit for non-parent caretaker relative of dependent child equal to 185% of federal poverty guidelines. The bill extends the sunset date to 2019, allowing an increase in cash assistance paid to families enrolled in state family pre-supplemental security insurance or Social Security Disability Insurance Program. The bill extends the sunset to 2019 to increase in duration the period that a family receiving TANF may continue to receive assistance upon becoming ineligible due to employment or increased hours of work. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Good morning, Chair Kinnegar and members of the committee. My name is Jill Gray, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the self-sufficiency program at the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to talk to you about that bill with the incredibly long summary on it. And I think that you can probably figure out from the summary that this bill deals with the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, otherwise known as TANF. I think most members on this committee are probably pretty familiar with the TANF program, but just very briefly, it is a cash assistance an employment program that helps families with children living in poverty pay for basic needs, and it also provides services to help parents find jobs and stay employed. It also offers support services such as helping to pay for child care and transportation while those parents are involved in job preparation programs or while they're searching for employment. And TANF also offers a variety of other assistance, such as assistance to domestic violence survivors. That is a particular issue that we have been working with Representative Peluso on. I have a feeling we'll probably be back at a later date to talk more in depth about that. So for today, I'll just mention it and we can move on. I noticed that I skipped over one item I wanted to mention, which is I said that the program helps families in poverty, but what does that mean? In Oregon, a family in order to be eligible for the TANF program has to be at 37% of the federal poverty level or less. To put that into some actual numbers, for a family of three, so a family such as a mom and two children, that means that family can have income only up to $616 per month in order to be eligible for the program. If that family earns even $1 more than that, they are over income and are not eligible to enter the TANF program. So when we are talking about families in poverty, what we're really talking about are families in very deep poverty. That, I know we have limited time, that is a very quick explanation about the program and a little bit about who it serves. To go back to the bill in front of you today, House Bill 2347, I will be the first one to admit that reading that bill is not the easiest thing to understand what it's doing. And so here is a very brief description with a little bit of history that'll help put it in context. So come back with me to 2007. And during the 2007 session, there was a TANF bill that session as well. It was House Bill 2469. The sponsor on that bill was Speaker Kotek, before she was Speaker Kotek, and the bill had to do with really enhancing enhancing the TANF program. What it required was the department to deliver much more individualized services to families. I heard it described as, and I'm so sorry if I'm stealing your talking point right now, but I heard it described as really taking the TANF program and making it a very Oregon program so that it was really reflective of what the state wanted to see out of the TANF program and could serve families here in Oregon with the unique set of challenges that they were facing here in Oregon better. And I think that's a pretty fair description of 2469. 2469 passed in 2007, and the department started implementing it later that year. And over the course of the following year, I think we were seeing some really good results from that bill passage. And not too terribly long after that, the recession started in Oregon, and the TANF program saw what I think many programs saw, a very dramatically increased caseload at the same time we were seeing fewer and fewer resources available. And so what the legislature ultimately did in the 2009 session was to approve putting portions of the TANF program in suspension. So in other words, those portions of the TANF program in suspension would not be funded. Just a couple of examples of what those portions of the TANF program that are in suspension included were the Parents of Scholars program. So it was trying to help TANF families who wanted to further their educational goals. There were some employment services that were put into suspension. Back in 2007, we had a much more robust post-TANF program that was really trying to help families as they transition off the program. That also was put into suspension. So that is not an exhaustive list. That is just some examples of what was put into suspension. And you may be wondering, that happened in 2009. What has happened since then? Those portions of the TANF program that were put in suspension have remained in suspension ever since then. And so the bill in front of you today would continue those same TANF suspensions for another biennia. So in other words, it's really keeping in place what is currently happening with the TANF program for another 2 years. That's really all it's doing. I think a natural question that some committee members may be asking is this the plan for TANF, that we're just going to keep asking for an extension of those suspensions? And the answer is no. And I think to more fully describe the answer, it's helpful to remember that in the 2015 session, we had a TANF bill. It was House Bill 3535. The co-leads on that bill were Representative Peluso and Representative Stark. And one of the focuses of that bill was to ease the benefit cliff for families. So in other words, as a family's income increased, there's a resulting decrease in benefits. And sometimes families were facing a situation where their incomes were increasing very modestly, but the resulting decrease in assistance was sometimes very dramatic and sometimes very sharp. There would be a huge difference from one month to the next. One of the comments that we used during the House Bill 3535 discussions was that we wanted to make that much more of a glide path for families and have them always be able to make that transition much easier and much more successful as they move on and up off the program. House Bill 3535 is still a new bill for us, but I think as we continue implementing it, it's going to give us a lot of really good and useful information about what's working well for families and probably what needs further improvement. So even though I did not ask Philip and Janet this before we sat down, I think I'm pretty comfortable in saying they'll agree that no, the long-term solution is not to continue asking for the suspensions to be continued, but rather we probably have a lot of work ahead of us to take in information from House Bill 3535 and other projects to really start that next phase of the conversation about what are the next steps for a longer-term plan for TANF. So more TANF work to come. I have one last point that I was going to make, and then I'll turn it over to Philip and Janet, and that is the TANF suspensions are in the governor's recommended budget. It was part of what was assumed in her budget, and they're also in the co-chair's framework budget. The co-chair's framework budget doesn't offer us a lot of detail, but I think it's safe to assume that these continued TANF suspensions are in the framework budget. One of the few specific points that the co-chair's framework budget offered was a concern about reductions to the department would probably impact the TANF program. And I think Janet and Philip may have more to say about that, so I will leave it with that and just say I hope that was helpful to explain what that bill is doing, and that I hope the history behind it is also helpful to put a little context around it. And I think we'll turn it over before we take questions. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. That was very thorough, Joe.
Madam Chair, members of the Committee for Record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Oregon Food Bank. I'm here as part of a group of organizations that is known as the TANF Alliance. We are, you know, a bunch of nonprofit social services, also advocates that are concerned about Oregon's most vulnerable populations, in particular, obviously, parents with small children, which is what the TANF program is about. And I do want to start by expressing some gratitude towards members of this committee and other members that have been part of this ongoing conversation to have a TANF program that actually works for families. So I want to give credit to Rep. Peluso, Rep. Stark, Rep. Olson, who just stepped out, but many others who've been working on this program for quite some time, and as Chair said, since 2007, which for me was sort of like the high watermark, just in terms of we finally had a set of policies and resources that the best minds at the time felt was necessary for the program to actually work for families. But then unfortunately, over the past decade, we've had, you know, changes within our economy, higher demand for services, and also changes in the amount of resources made available to families on the program. So, I mean, being a bearer of bad news, essentially, we have a program that works on paper, but in reality doesn't have the sufficient resources to actually help families to escape poverty. And I think in many ways we still haven't recovered from the 2009-11 cuts, when you had a lot of support services where a family who's coming into the program, they have to be pretty much destitute, and they're going to have greater needs, whether it's domestic violence, mental health, drug or alcohol, or, you know, they have a learning disability because maybe they were brought up in a household where there was either abuse or other adverse childhood experiences that has impacted them into adulthood. Well, a lot of those services have been discontinued, and still to this day. So in many ways, a lot of what you're seeing in the suspension bill keeps on the books those programs that were developed at, you know, from the spirit of 2007's 2469 bill. So I do want to say that we are still facing a lot of, obviously, fiscal challenges, and I want to share with you the TANF Alliance's recommendations that will be shared by my colleague Janet Bauer with Oregon Center for Public Policy. We've been obviously very concerned with what the governor's recommended budget is and what it means. So at this point, I want to turn it over to Janet.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Gennigeyer, vice chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and pleased to be with you today. As a TANF Alliance, we have talked about what the critical supports are that would help families be successful. Many families on the program now are successful. We do not have sufficient investment in the program to allow all families who can be successful to be successful, and they can. So we have identified a number of things that simple approaches that we think are high priorities in building the program and making it effective as a way for families to escape poverty and achieve economic opportunity that they need to succeed. The first is to reject time limits to the program. Right now, families have a lifetime limit of 60 months on the program. That's 5 years. That's just a quarter of the time that parents are parenting typically. And although the governor's budget does not call for cuts of that kind, the co-chair's budget does indicate that there would be, without additional revenue, deep cuts to the TANF program, and in our view would very likely include reductions in the time limit. That's the primary way the department has identified that savings could be made in the program. However, that's not wise, because it targets the families who need the help the most. It would target families who have the greatest barriers. So we advise rejecting any proposals that would lower or reduce the limit that families can receive assistance. Secondly, we believe that the grant amount needs to be increased. The grant amount has been eroding for years and years, and the legislature has neglected monitoring this issue. Decades ago, families could receive a cash grant amount if they had no other income that would equate to about 70% of the federal poverty level, and that was extremely helpful in helping them meet their basic needs and get back on their feet. Now that level is just 31% of the federal poverty level, and that really puts families at risk of homelessness. It's extremely difficult for families to make ends meet on that. So we think that is a high priority for the legislature to address and make an investment in. Thirdly, services need to be more culturally responsive. Many families experience structures in our systems that are holdovers from are a product of racism in our society and other ways in which oppression to individuals are perpetuated. There's a lot of research that we know now about how those barriers keep people from succeeding, and we need to look more closely at how the program can overcome perpetuating structures that make it hard for people with of different cultures to succeed in the program. And last, we believe that we need to create a cycle of success inherent in the program. And what we mean by that is, as we are successful in families moving out of the program and there are savings, budgetary savings, that accrue to the state, those savings need to be invested back into the program to build up the supports, as we've been talking about, so that all families who aren't getting enough assistance can depart the program successfully. That ends my comments. I'm very happy to take questions, and thank you.
Thank you. I know we're running short on this. You've done a lot of work, and a lot of this actually lies in the Budget Committee. So my understanding of this bill is that you're suspending the pieces of the bill that ask that the program do specific things because of we're so cash-strapped, and we want to continue on the path that that Representative Peluso and Representative Stark worked on and continue to prioritize those kinds of things, as well as not imposing a new age limit where we haven't had one. Is that correct? I don't think we have the age limit right now, so we want to continue not having it. Not age limit, duration, 60 months.
Time limit. It would be shorter.
Right. So we are wanting to continue on the path that we've been on, which is not fully funding the program as it was envisioned in 2007, but prioritizing the areas that you've mentioned, which is why we're suspending some of the parts of 2007 because of the fiscal concerns.
Right.
Otherwise, the program would be mandated to do it because it was part of 2007. So we have to officially suspend it to ensure that the department does not spend money on those aspects of the program.
Yes.
Chair Kenegaier, members of the committee, I should have called your attention to the fact sheet that our alliance has put out on the topics that I just went over. So those are all identified and explained further in the one-page fact sheet. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2347, open a House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 2684. Cassie, could you please read a summary? And in the meantime, can we please have Emily Skolowski, Kendall Mason, and Gordon DiQuattro come up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2684 establishes a minimum hourly wage of $15 per hour for employees who provide direct care to residents of residential training facilities or residential training homes. The bill allows Department of Human Services to adopt rules implementing the minimum hourly wage rate and requires residential training facility or residential training homes to submit an annual financial statement to DHS no later than October 31st. The bill establishes a civil penalty for each occurrence of substantiated abuse resulting in death, serious injury, rape, or sexual abuse of a resident. The bill authorizes private action against the residential training facility or residential training home for retaliation against a person reporting the abuse. The bill requires the director of DHS to establish rules requiring residential training facility or the residential training home to employ staff sufficient for individual resident needs and directs DHS to conduct annual inspections of every residential training facility and residential training home to determine compliance of maintenance and operation with Oregon law. The bill has a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Yes, good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. My name is Emily Sokolsky. I'm a senior researcher with the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. I appreciate the opportunity to share Local 503's research report, Broken Promises, Our Group Homes Failing People with Developmental Disabilities, and express our support for House Bill 2684. Our report goes into greater detail, but I want to focus on four components: the cost of service, workforce, abuse, and transparency. I also want to define some terms because I know some of these settings may seem very similar. Adult foster homes are settings that serve four or fewer people with IDD. Group homes generally have a higher capacity. Personal support workers are the workers that serve people in their own homes. And direct support providers are the service providers that work in group homes and adult foster homes and supported living. Just to describe the system a little bit, there are 81 group home providers in the state of Oregon, representing 765 facilities, 1,276 beds. There are about 2,800 people who are served in group homes, and that's 18% of the almost 1,600 adults receiving IDD services in Oregon. Group homes also received $550 million in payments over the 2015-2017 biennium. Let's see. In addition to significant funding, group homes represent the highest average cost per case of IDD services. Yet this system is subject to very few reporting requirements. As I mentioned before, the workforce serving people with IDD are called direct support professionals. The Oregon Resource Associations, which is one of the trade groups representing group home providers, identifies 14,000 DSPs in Oregon. This workforce has high turnover. The most recent report to the legislature shows a turnover rate of 90%. ORA states that the average cost of turnover is $10,000 per worker. So if this data is accurate, then the average cost of turnover could be up to $126 million annually. Low wages are a contributing factor to turnover. When the reimbursement rate was updated in 2008, it was predicated on an average wage of $12.94. When the legislature approved a 4% increase to the rate in 2015, the average wage should have gone up to $13.45 an hour. However, our analysis of 33 providers' job postings on Craigslist and their own websites between September 12th and September 23rd, 2016, found all were advertising below $12.94, and the average advertised starting wage was actually $10.88. And we acknowledge that the rate model is just intended to be an average, and we only identified postings for 40% of providers, but we still feel the results are meaningful. So if our understanding of turnover costs is accurate, then turnover alone could represent up to 45% of payments to providers in fiscal year 2015. These funds alone could increase the DSP wage by $381 an hour for everyone in the workforce. And I'd like to acknowledge that our report actually incorrectly cites this as $378 an hour, and that was due to an error on my part when calculating the employer's share of payroll taxes. We analyzed abuse data that is published in the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Information. The acronym for that agency is OAAPI. We looked at OAAPI's annual reports on abuse, and we also did a public information request to OAAPI and the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight on abuse complaints occurring between 2013 and 2015. The data published in OAAPI's report shows that, on average, group homes represented 71% of all substantiated abuse claims over the periods listed in this chart. And I should note that the data we received from our public records request from OAAPI and OLRO doesn't actually match the data that's published in this report. The data we received from OAPI shows between 669 and 571 abuse complaints every year between 2013 and 2015. And the highest number of complaints are for neglect, verbal abuse, and financial abuse. Between 40 and 50% of allegations were substantiated in these years. But I also want to note that between 12 and 26 cases were either inconclusive or the results were not on file with the agency. The categories of abuse with the highest rates of substantiation were neglect, financial abuse, and verbal abuse. The descriptions of harm include financial abuse, theft of funds, sometimes in the thousands, personal possessions, medication, misuse of an individual's SNAP benefits. Neglect included not following the individual support plan, leading to the harm or potential harm of the person in many types of situations. Physical abuse, including hitting with hands, feet, objects, unauthorized restraint. Sexual abuse included kissing, exposure to sexual images. Verbal abuse included using profanity when speaking about or addressing people in the home. Threatening violence, including threatening to kill the individual, threatening punitive action, sexual comments, racial slurs. And all of this, I do feel, should be viewed with skepticism, because even though a third party could not substantiate an interaction between two people that may or may not have involved witnesses, does not mean that the abuse did not occur. And we would be happy to share the data with the committee. Even when cases are substantiated, an average of 48% received no enforcement action over the three-year period. We do feel that enhanced enforcement, including mandatory penalties for substantiated abuse and additional protections for whistleblowers, will help decrease abuse in these settings. And overall, we believe that the system really needs greater transparency. Group homes received $550 million in Medicaid payments in fiscal year 2014 and 2015. Overall, Medicaid represents 90% of revenue within the system. This is only slightly higher than nursing homes, where 78% of revenue is attributed to public payers. However, nursing homes are subject to much more detailed financial disclosures. Given the expense of these settings and significant use of public funding, we advocate for an equivalent level of disclosure here. We further advocate for disclosure of significant subsidiaries and subcontractor relationships. Several group home providers offer related services within the system. Examples include case management. There's at least one provider who's a contracted case management entity in several counties. Employment services. There are 14 group home providers that still operate sheltered workshops where the workers there earn between $4 and $6 an hour. And property ownership. For example, ORA owns 16 group homes that they lease back to providers. So the high cost of this system, significant amount of abuse, and potential for conflicts of interest makes greater transparency, we think, especially crucial here to ensuring that services are delivered safely, efficiently, and with respect for the autonomy of people served and for the workers. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And are you planning on putting the corrected version up on on OLIS?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. That would be great. Thank you. Kendall. You have a lot of people behind you on this
yes,
bill.
Yes. So. I'm going to amend parts of my... As we go. Chair...
The OLIS as well.
Yes. So you yes. See it all. Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Kendall Mason, and I'm a policy strategist for SEIU Local 503. Thanks for having me. And I'm going to kind of breeze through this really quick. I'm here... testifying in support of House Bill 2684. We feel like it has a three-pronged approach of transparency, enhanced enforcement, and then the wage pass-through for direct support professionals, which we've all agreed is crucial to the system at this point. Each component of the bill is to ensure the legislature, the department, and other policymakers are equipped with as much information as possible to make well-informed decisions about policy and funding now and into the future. And we believe that House Bill 2684 offers protections for some of Oregonians' most vulnerable people, as well as enhances the workplace for the dedicated workers who are providing those services. In Section 3 of House Bill 2684, it creates a much more transparent and accountable service delivery process. It's pretty clear that the current system itself is anything but clear and transparent. It's a complicated web of services, and it makes it difficult to assure that we are meeting the primary objective of providing people with support system that allows for independence, dignity, and choice. While it's one of the most expensive delivery systems in long-term care, the wages are the lowest when compared to other long-term care providers, and the turnover rate is roughly 90%, and we've just seen exactly how much that can cost, turnover itself at least. A system that's operating almost entirely on Medicaid funding, it's in the best interest for us to all truly understand how the rates support the delivery services to the consumers. What would be included in this level of transparency sort of mirrors what is currently existing in the nursing facility rate structure. It includes full disclosure of financials and where funding is derived from and where it's spent. And it also includes disclosure of board membership as well as conflicts of interest or entities that could pose a conflict of interest, something that was just also outlined in the report. Second, and sections 4, 5, and 6, they propose to enhance enforcement mechanisms by finally providing critically needed accountability, oversight, and worker protections. It adds enhanced whistleblower protections for workers who report abuse, and it will allow them to report that abuse without fear of retribution or retaliation. It also includes a clear definition of the license renewal fee. There's currently a lot of murky waters around who collects and when the renewal license fee is collected, and it seems substantially that's unclear if renewal fees are actually collected. And Emily mentioned earlier it would also call for an increase in fine and mandatory enforcement around some of the substantiated complaints. As we've seen, there's a 48% question mark on what happens after a substantiated abuse. And lastly, of course, it proposes lifting the wages for direct support professionals. It's coupled with a wage pass-through. It's no secret that wages for DSPs are some of the lowest in long-term spectrum, and that those wages are a clear cause of the near-constant turnover. It calls for a direct wage pass-through to DSPs to ensure that the rate increase, or any rate increase, is reflected in a corresponding increase in worker wages. More than 21 states have enacted a wage pass-through for direct care providers in long-term care, which means a lot of states are recognizing that low wages contribute to high turnover and poor quality of care. As we consider continually increasing the rates in this community, we need to make sure rates are being passed along directly to the workers. And without transparency and accountability, there's really no way for the legislature or the agency to ensure the efforts to increase wages through rate increases are actually reflected in worker paychecks. Thank you for taking the time to consider these different elements of House Bill 2684. As a three-pronged approach, we feel like it's the right step in fixing what we see as a broken system.
Thank you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, good morning. Thank you for having me here. My name is Gordon DiQuattro. I'm a direct support professional with Albert Taylor down in Eugene, Springfield. I'm here to attest to the really urgent need for transparency, enforcement, and a direct wage increase for DSPs. We really need to provide these agencies with the funds necessary to pay their workers a living wage while holding passing strong legislation to hold them accountable for where the money is going. Our entire community is really at stake here. As a group home worker, I understand the need for increased wages. It's badly needed. Even when working full time and then some, I can't even afford to keep up with the interest on my nearly $80,000 of student loans, which makes it really difficult to put off the really Sophie's choice of being short on rent or being short on food for any given pay period. This sort of constant stress of clocking in, spending 8 to 10 hours, 16 hours sometimes taking care of somebody, and then clocking out and having to immediately start to worry about your own well-being and how you're going to take care of yourself, unfortunately, and at no fault of the employee, diminishes their capacity for compassion, for patience, and for vigilance, all of which is incredibly necessary in care work. Unfortunately, over time, that constant stress is overwhelming, and oftentimes we lose very good staff for very poor reasons, and as a result, our individuals lose very good friends. All that said, as it is, when the state does increase rates for group homes, there's no guarantee that the funds are going to be used wisely and that workers and individuals are going to see the best returns for state investment. When we passed the 4% increase, my agency sent out an email almost immediately saying that rising health care costs would result in the absorption of the 4% increase and that we should not expect a pay raise. Thankfully, because we do have a union at our backs, we were able to stop that and bargain almost a 12% increase across the board. But the only reason we were able to do that was because we had strong backing, which is something that unfortunately is not available to most in my field. We need transparency and accountability in these group homes. Right now, we unfortunately have none. We aren't ensuring that these Medicaid dollars are spent to actually improve the lives of the individuals we support and to actually support the people that support them. We are a community. A strong relationship. We need clear and strong language that stipulates how the money will be spent and empowers people to actually hold the agencies accountable. This year, with House Bill 2684, we have the opportunity to really put into place the strong language that's needed. The state made a commitment when Fairview closed that Oregonians with disabilities would be well supported in the community, and there's no way to do that unless the people who provide direct care for them are paid a living wage and don't have to worry about their own well-being. Just as individuals in the care of the skilled nursing facilities are assured that their funds are spent to actually make their lives better, the public needs a commensurate level of transparency in group homes that can ensure us that the state is fulfilling its promises to individuals with developmental disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Can we please have Darla Pena, Andrea Helm, and Lily Hoag? And again, if you can be as brief as possible, give everyone a chance to say something.
Good morning, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson. My name is Darla Pena, and I am a direct support professional. And I'm here to talk about the importance of House Bill 2684. I know that just throwing money at organizations will not fix this problem. We need more transparency, and all these organizations need to be held accountable. Our nonprofit agencies are operating like they're for-profit and have forgotten their mission statements of serving individuals in the community. Individuals' needs are not being met, despite being the most expensive care setting in the state. At my agency, our individuals are no longer able to go on much-needed trips unless they have volunteer staff or their care providers like myself are able to pay for the trip, stay, and all the costs and amenities that go along with it. For example, the individual I support has been wanting to go to D.C. for longer than I've been supporting him. However, this last year during his ISP meeting, we were told to basically just forget it because it was not going to happen, which is offensive to me as a direct support professional because my job is to ensure that his needs are not only being met, but he is being treated fairly. And then to find out that not only is he not able to go to D.C. still, but my agency supported and funded a 5-day trip to Hawaii at the beginning of this year for a supported living direct support professional, which I find offensive as well. And I struggle just to make ends meet just like the rest of my coworkers. Just this last pay period, I worked over 101 hours to make sure that I had enough money to not only pay my rent, but anything that my car needs. I have dogs. They need care. I have a cat. They need care. And my husband. We need food. We need shelter. We need amenities as well. 50 hours a week of direct support that I provide just to live and provide for my family. That's a lot of hours away from my home as a single income home. And I make more than most individuals, most direct support professionals in my industry, and it's still not enough. It's a burden to provide food and shelter and even my small creature comforts. Do you know what it's like to go into Walmart and buy Walmart brand meat and cook it in your Walmart pan and put it away in your Walmart brand Ziploc bags? I don't know if you do, but I know that direct purchasing of goods, and it is very, very a low blow, actually, because I should be able to make enough money to purchase maybe some Ziploc brand bags and not great value brand bags, or maybe buy myself some Umqua ice cream and not have to buy great value ice cream and wonder what it is that I'm actually consuming. This kind of struggle affects self-confidence, job, and job performance. It's almost impossible to talk about just one issue with this lifestyle because it is a vicious circle. Lack of money creates unhappy living environment, which affects our worker moods. It's really depressing to go into work and provide care for somebody who lives a higher quality of life than you do, and you still struggle over 50 hours a week to provide a much higher quality of life than you're able to provide for yourself. From helping this individual order a Big Mac to helping them wash themselves, our attitude affects the everyday life of the individuals I support. And believe me, they can tell right away, even if I can't tell that something's wrong. They're very intuitive. I often eat the same thing repeatedly for weeks at a time, sometimes all month long, because it's affordable and I can make it. Last week, I bought a package of markers after completing all of my financial obligations, and I have $20 left to my name until the 11th of this month.
Darla, would you like to wrap up and then submit your testimony?
I do this work because I love it, but I am tired of working for poverty wages and never fully understanding why most expensive care sitting in our state still can provide the independence and dignity it says it does for consumers while at the same time paying such low wages to workers. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me. I urge you to support House Bill 2684 because it's time that the workers like myself got a raise and legislators understood exactly what this expense form of support is paying for. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Lily Hogue. I'm the director of Oregon Care Works. We're here testifying in support of HB 2684 today. A couple of weeks ago, you heard from the author Laura Dresser about the care economy and why it's so important that we link the well-being of caregivers with the well-being of those people who are receiving care. because as we all know, that care work is the work that makes all other work possible and is also the backbone of our community. So we're here today supporting this bill because we actually need to invest in care jobs. These are the fastest growing jobs in our state and in our country. And currently, your average care worker is making about $20,000 a year. We've heard about that. And that causes turnover of about 90% in this field, which means that people aren't receiving the stable quality kind of care they deserve, and we're not living up to our values as a community. If we want to talk about dignity and care, we must raise wages, and we must also make it possible to understand how we spend our state dollars and how we invest effectively, not just in making sure that people can sustain day-to-day, but that we can actually allow families who are providing care or receiving care to live with dignity and thrive. And that will involve a long-term system of workforce development and in enhancing and improving transparency in our system. And this bill is a really good step forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Hain. I'm a direct support professional, and I'm going to skip large chunks that have been covered and jump directly to why is high turnover a problem for clients? I want you to imagine that you are a resident in a group home for a moment and that you possibly never or rarely get visitors and that you spend all your evenings and holidays with your housemates and staff. Maybe you don't even like your housemates, or maybe you do, but they don't pay much attention to you. Maybe you're nonverbal and have a unique way of communicating. The only people who regularly express interest in you, who want to get to know you, who care about your well-being on a day-to-day basis, sometimes are your staff. This certainly isn't the case for all clients, but it is the case for many, including the three young men I support. For many clients, a specific staff member is the most important member or person in the world to them, and then that staff member leaves. I saw an example of this a couple months ago when I filled in at a house that had recently lost most of its staff. When one or two people leave, the remaining staff must pick up extra hours and cannot leave if the next person doesn't show up for their shift. The burden is huge, and what starts as a trickle can easily become a waterfall of quitting staff. This house had only two remaining staff, and one had only been hired 2 weeks ago. And I can't go into details, but the clients were obviously miserable. Their house was full of strangers, and all the people they knew and trust were gone. And to add to the burden, most of them were nonverbal. And what was once a happy and calm house had turned into chaos, which made it even more difficult to attract and keep new staff. Most low-wage jobs are intended to be temporary or a stepping stone to higher positions. But that's not the goal of this job. The goal of this job is to be a direct support professional for your career and to stay with the same client or clients for decades. Every client deserves that kind of dedication and stability. Unfortunately, most people cannot support themselves on these wages. I am fortunate enough to make a slightly higher wage than average as a DSP, and I am personally able to make ends meet, plus save a little, working just 40 hours a week. But I have no student loans, no car payments, I walk to work, no debts, no illnesses, and no children. This is not the case for most of my coworkers. In order to pay their bills, most of my coworkers have to work overtime hours. I have one coworker who has two children and lives in Vancouver. He drives down to Beaverton or Milwaukee for a 7 to 8 hour shift in the morning and then drives to Northeast Portland for an 8 hour shift in the evening. He does this 6 days a week and rarely gets to spend time with his children. The other day, this coworker was telling me how he had always wanted his children to know their father better than he knew his, but he didn't know how it was possible with how much he had to work. I don't want that for my future. I want children someday, so I've been saving every penny towards education or classes for a new career, one that can support a family. It saddens me because I don't want to leave my clients, but I also don't want to make that type of personal sacrifice. I hope that someday DSPs won't have to.
Thank you very much. In the interest of time, we're going to continue going forward, so thank you. So Eva Repeteau and Chris Burnett. And Eva, if you're in favor of this bill, then maybe you can keep it really short and point to your testimony on OLIS.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez, and members of the committee. I'm Eva Repeteau with AFSCME Council 75. We represent four nonprofit group homes for IDD residents and then the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. We appreciate the work in the report that SEIU has put forward and agree with their policy recommendations to raise wages, have better transparency, financial transparency, increase penalties for the agencies abuse and neglect, and then provide the whistleblower protections. Excuse me, my voice is leaving. And I'm sure if I forgot something, we're just supportive. Yes. Residents in group homes and other care settings deserve stable, well-trained workforce. As the previous person just testified, it is incredibly important that people know and trust the people that are giving them care. And when there's instability in the workforce, that doesn't happen, and it leads to difficulties in the homes. The workforce deserves wages that are offered above the fast food restaurants and proper staffing to ensure that they are providing the best supports possible. And then the whistleblower protections so that they know when they're doing their moral and legal obligation of reporting abuse and neglect that they won't be retaliated against. And if they are, that there are measures that protect them. It's uncomfortable to talk about that's an issue, but it is. And I've heard throughout the years of working at AFSCME from several DSPs and other people working in the industry that this is an issue, that they don't always feel comfortable calling out neglect. Usually it's something that's, you know, not life or death, but still demeaning and demoralizing for a resident. But they're fearful of retaliation from their employer, and they shouldn't be. Some things that also I've heard from, some other things I've also heard are the need for transparency. I do want to call that in a previous hearing that you've heard from Albertina Kerr that they had increased their wages by 22.6%. However, the contractually bargained wages that for the people that we represent have an average increase of 7.4% since 2009. And perhaps the increases that Albertina Kerr shared included individuals who'd received promotions and job changes, or included management or direct or non-direct care staff. But those increases do not represent the DSP wage increases. The financial transparency piece in HB 2684 would go a long way to help us understand how state money is being spent to support residents and the employees in their programs. I also like to point out that transparency and accountability can also be built into data systems that are currently available to the state that private homes could also use. And I can supply some testimony from one of our members who's done some research on that as well. Additionally, inspection requirements that are in 2684, great idea. These are provided in other care settings. Like, for example, our in-home child care providers receive annual inspections as well.
Is it annual or every other year?
For certified, it's annual, and I believe that registered are also moving to annual. They have been every other year, and there are unannounced and announced visits, and I think that this is a reasonable requirement for all caregiving settings. So with that, I'll wrap up, and I will be submitting written testimony and some supplemental materials as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Chris Burnett. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Resource Association. Chair Guinea-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. As you've heard, we Oregon's providers, partners, are in the midst of an unprecedented direct care workforce staffing crisis. Our staff who support individuals who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities are leaving the field in record numbers due to poverty wages. We agree with the arguments made by SEIU today. Immediate action is needed to resolve the statewide crisis, which is why we support the underlying goals of HB 2684. We represent over 60 providers of community agencies in Oregon who support individuals with IDD. In agency-operated 24-hour comprehensive service homes, as well as employment and non-work day supports. Our members are key partners to the Department of Human Services in supporting individuals with IDD in Oregon. Comprehensive 24-hour wraparound services provided by community not-for-profit providers are in place for those with the highest support needs and are what keep people out of crisis. Our member community agencies are the difference between a costly state-operated crisis support and a home in the community near family and friends, even for those with high support needs. Unlike for-profit entities, we, your Oregon service providers, are dependent on the state for our funding. We have absorbed the rising costs of direct support professional positions without a mandate, including increases when we could, without additional funding increases or COLA since 2009. The 4% rate increase effective January 1, 2016 doesn't really get wages for DSPs past the poverty stage. DSPs are the critical element of care, as you've heard and you know. For those who support their need, who need to live a full, inclusive life. However, these poverty wages are forcing many to choose jobs with higher pay to support themselves and their families. This is causing critical retention and recruitment issues for service providers across the state and escalating costs of retraining. While we don't support every component presented in HB 2684, we do support the intent behind it, which is why we drafted a similar bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 238, which would require DHS to pay agencies that provide residential support services at a rate that allows them to pay an average wage that is 150% of minimum wage. This concept builds off the statewide minimum wage that you passed last year, ensuring regional flexibility while increasing wages, and also includes the essential element of a professional career path, utilizing national best practice. You have heard lots of support today for higher wages. It is our hope that the chair and sponsors of HB 2684 would convene the interested parties of these two bills, HB 2684 and Senate Bill 238, and allow us an opportunity to combine the best of both bills. Essentially, we are asking for a work group and more time to get this right. Together, we believe that there's a path forward for increased wages for DSPs. I would also like to add that we just recently saw the report from SEIU, and we'll follow up with all of you with our response and concerns about some pretty gross inaccuracies in the report. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions?
So I appreciate the statements by Ms. Bruna. And I would like to point out that in two different sessions, 2013 and 2015, I've also brought forth bills that would get at providing better supports for employees and ask for a work group, and have met with them but have met a lot of resistance. So I hope that it's a good faith effort this time around.
Yeah, can I ask a question?
I'd like to respond to.
So Eva, yeah. I'm just curious, the whistleblower part of the law, the bill that you're seeking, that applies, essentially the whole concept of what's happening with that statute for whistleblower deals with public employees. You're shifting gears. I guess that is public employees, isn't it?
Chair Kinnegan, Vice Chair Olson, for the whistleblower protections in the IDD group homes, I believe that they're private nonprofit homes. Okay. We do have the group homes that are run by the state, the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. So I imagine that they would fall under the state protections versus the private nonprofit group homes.
Well, that's what I was actually, thank you. That's where I was trying to get to with that question was, I don't know if you need that with the protections that already exist for the discrimination piece for the workplace. I don't know.
So we will look into that.
But if I could just briefly have
30 seconds, because I really want to leave time for the last
we,
bill.
We have had interactions, meetings with SEIU and AFSCME, not so much AFSCME, but SEIU, and they were predicated on getting our non-organized members organized, not as much on the wage. So I just want to be clear about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Going to close the House public hearing on House Bill 2684, open the House public hearing on House Bill 2685. And Cassie, could you please read us a summary while I call up Sarah Schneider, Anna Voy Brown, and Eric Ferguson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2685 requires Department of Human Services to present an adult with disabilities who is eligible to receive comprehensive services, one placement option, including providing assistance to maintain the individual within their own home or the home of the individual's family.
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Eric Ferguson, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2685. Because I passionately believe we need to go further to ensure that adults with developmental or intellectual disabilities receive a choice of living situation, which includes the possibility of living in the community with in-home support. I think that there's still an institutional bias at work that filters people towards group home settings, and those are not always the best settings because of some of the issues that you heard about in the last bill. It's widely understood via the Olmstead situation that, quote, confinement in an institution severely diminishes the everyday life activities of individuals, including family relations, social contacts, work options, economic independence, educational advancement, and cultural enrichment. As a person with a disability who has many friends with disabilities, I've witnessed firsthand the isolation that inappropriate institutional placements can cause. I've witnessed people in their 30s placed in nursing facilities with individuals much older than themselves. They lack the freedom to choose the time and quality of care they received, and age-appropriate recreational activity was completely unavailable. Depression, hopelessness, and excessive physical illness became commonplace. I've spent most of my adult life afraid of the same fate. For now, I'm lucky. I live in my own home with my wife, who also experiences a disability. We have part-time jobs and are working artists. We are taxpayers. We have a fine network of neighbors and friends. We have pets, a cat and a dog, and are generally thriving. And none of this would be possible without a network of home care workers funded through a Medicaid-based program. And I'd like to know that my friends with intellectual and developmental disabilities are offered the same choice to thrive. And while it may not be appropriate in every single case, I believe it is possible, even in the case of a severe disability, to live in the community and experience all of its benefits. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Schneider, and I'm the chair of the board of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is the only national disability civil rights organization run by and for people with developmental disabilities. I work for SEIU, but I'm testifying today as myself and not on behalf of ASAN or SEIU. As a person with a developmental disability and as a disability rights advocate, I support this bill because I believe nobody should be forced to live in an institution. Everybody deserves choices about where we live and who we live with. Right now, case managers are required to offer people coming into the DD service system at least three different options for service settings, but right now they can offer options that are all congregate segregated service settings that unnecessarily restrict people's autonomy, such as group homes and adult foster homes. I think when a lot of people think about segregation, they think about it in terms of racial segregation. They think about the civil rights movement. We all know that segregated schools are bad and that segregated lunch counters are bad. But I think a lot of people who are not intimately familiar with disability issues don't understand that legal segregation still exists for people with disabilities, that if you live in a group home or an adult foster home, only people with disabilities live in that home. And we know that separate but equal is not. It doesn't work that way. So if only people with disabilities live there, the quality of life is worse than everybody else is getting. And when you talk about going on an outing into the community, that's a tip that you're not actually living in the community to begin with. So group homes and adult foster homes are not community settings. They're segregated. The Olmstead decision in 1999 guaranteed people with disabilities the right to receive services in the most integrated setting possible. Nobody needs to live in a group home to get their support needs met. Many people end up in group homes because they either don't know what the other options are or because they can't find affordable, accessible housing. Any level of support needs can be met in a private home or apartment with in-home services as long as the state provides the right support. Segregated housing is a violation of our Olmstead rights. The lack of affordable housing is a huge issue, but providing support services in people's own homes saves the state an enormous amount of money. The average cost of providing support services in a group home is more than $9,200 per person per month. In-home services average only about $2,400 per month per case. SEIU research that was presented earlier, based on the data the providers themselves report, shows that group home worker turnover alone could cost the state up to $126 million per year. And for only an estimated $34 million, the state could pay for independent integrated housing at market rate for every person who currently lives in a group home. Another point I want to bring up is the idea of conflict of interest. If you live and receive services in a group home where your landlord and your service provider are the same entity, this creates a really dangerous power dynamic. Some of these providers also run sheltered workshops. So I want you to try to imagine that your landlord and your boss and the person who provides your support services, your bathing, your dressing, your meal preparation, are all the same person. And the potential for abuse that that creates when you can't complain about anything because you risk losing not only your support provider, you risk losing your home and your job all in one go. If you don't get along with your roommates and you want to move to a different house, you can't do that without also losing your support services and potentially your job. Or if you don't get along with your support provider and you just want a new support worker, the only way to change providers is to lose your housing and potentially end up homeless. So this system limits choices for people with disabilities and gives providers a dangerous level of power over people's lives. This bill, House Bill 2685, would require that case managers offer the option of independent living to everyone who comes into the DD system. This option is theoretically available to everybody, but unless case managers tell people that it's available and help them get into that option, people don't necessarily know about it. Living independently with whatever support services we need provided in our own homes or apartments should be the default option for people with developmental disabilities, not the exception. When support services are separated from real estate, people can make the decision to switch service providers without risking becoming homeless. Everybody should be able to choose where to live, and nobody should be forced to live in an institution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Well, is Anna Joy Brown here?
Yes.
Great. And Tiffany Russell and David Beam. Those are our final three. And we're going to try to wrap up at 5 minutes up because we've got two bills to pass. So if you can be as brief as possible. Mike, just pull up a chair from over there for yourself, from anywhere. Yeah. I sit next to him. You can pull it around. All right, great. Who's going first?
I'll go first.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Anna Joy Brown. I'm testifying in support of both House Bill 2685 and 2684. I am a mother of a child with developmental disabilities, and I have worked in and seen the developmental disability system from virtually all aspects. Many things require improvement, but for me personally, the lack of options, or I should say resources, to live independently for my son in a place of his choosing is a big problem. Our son Nathan is now 36 years old, lives with two other guys in our house, which is now turned into a group home, and run by Sunny Oaks in Monmouth. He has multiple severe and complicated disabilities, but he is able to use a one-arm manual wheelchair, and he because he does have the use of one arm, and he's also nonverbal, so is dependent on others to know and to use his communication systems. He does know some sign language and can use picture icons, but only if people are trained on how to use these. He has his own business called Nathan's Choice, where he delivers coffee to customers. He's an integrated and productive worker in the community, and we are very proud of him. Nathan lived with us until he was 33. As with most people with developmental disabilities, moving out of a home is a forced decision due to a lack of resources. For years, Nathan refused to even visit group homes. He refused to have people from group homes come visit him. He did not want to live outside his home.
the only viable choice that existed for us was for us to move out of our home instead of him. If we wanted our son to live in a place of his choosing in his hometown, in a wheelchair accessible home where he has social connections which cannot be replicated anywhere else, living where he does now was a forced choice. Nathan has good staff, but the house is chronically understaffed. They can maintain basic health and safety when fully staffed, but do not have the time or resources to train staff, for instance, to use our son's augmentative communication systems. So he vocalizes and sometimes points in a general direction, but basically his staff cannot communicate with him his way. I think this is tragic. The lack of resources and options to live independently hurts Nathan, and it hurts the people and agencies that want to help him. It makes it hard for them to do their job right. We've even had some employees cry because they could not afford to continue living on the wages that were paid, and they had to leave the field. They weren't the only ones who cried. Nathan pays the price. We need to make sure that people with developmental disabilities have real options and choices so they can live integrated and dignified lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody next?
Mr. Chairman, my name's David Beam. I'm an advocate for special needs population in the state for all the disability people. I just got appointed under the governor for all the disability people in the state. So I was wondering if we can get a 10-pound program for the state of Oregon because of this problem in the state. You got a lot of people come out of Fairview, don't have no system in the state. We got a waiting list so high in the state of Oregon, on Marion County, on the waiting list, don't have no services, are homeless in the state of Oregon. No services after 5 o'clock here because the mental health is shut down in the state of Oregon. So I was thinking, I was testified for Marion County, get a drop-in center for each county, and be the first one in the state will fund this program for all the services from out of the mental health system in the state and in the mental health program. Be the first one in the nation to be the first one to be done legal, and make sure all the services there in the registration where run the money where it goes, and it goes to all the counties funding. We get state funding and federal funds will be here and goes to the registrator, then don't run the system. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe you, I'm thinking that might be a great pilot project for you to work with Representative Nierman on.
Good, thanks. I'm Representative Nierman, and I'm here to support House Bill 2685, and I'll yield the balance of my time to the experts.
Thank you, Representative Nierman. Okay.
Hi.
Last one.
My name is Tiffany Russell, and my son Josh has cerebral palsy, and I'm his full-time caregiver. I also work as a direct support provider in a group home for Bethesda for the past 20 years. I would like to share my personal and professional experiences about options for people with disabilities. My son Josh is 27 and has CP, and I provide all of the care in order for Josh to receive benefits. We have lived on the $12 an hour I make after 20 years of working at the same group home. It's been a huge struggle for us. I would have to make sure to keep my income low in order for him to keep his benefits. I have stepped down and got passed over for jobs just so that he could keep his Social Security and his health insurance. When Josh turned 19, he moved into the brokerage system. Over the years, we had 3 case managers from 2 different agencies and still received no services for 5 years because no one told us what options we had and we didn't know what we could spend the money on. It was very frustrating. Josh's current case manager, who was wonderful, was shocked that I wasn't getting paid to do Josh's care, and within 1 month I was being paid to care for him, which is the reason he still lives at home. It's not fair that we didn't know we had those options. We were never told I could be paid to provide his care. I do not know why we weren't told from the beginning, but it's definitely changed our lives. Life has changed dramatically since I have started getting paid for his care. Our bills are always paid. Josh has begun to keep his own Social Security money, and for the first time ever, we have a savings account. In fact, next month we plan on buying a wheelchair van. I'll let Josh talk about that.
I would like to forgo the wheelchair van just for a second and talk about the options that I would have because of this bill. Without the option of receiving care at home, I would have to live in a group home or an assisted living facility. I can do things at home that I wouldn't be able to do in a group home, like picking my own meals and social outings. I can't do those in group home settings. I would hate to be forced into a different situation, not knowing that receiving care at home was an option.
I also want to talk about a couple of my clients at the group home where I work. I had two clients who were recently literally in tears thinking they were going to get kicked out on the streets because they had received a 90-day notice of termination of services from my employer. One client who showed me the letter they had gotten, it was a 30-day notice from Bethesda. They had no idea that it was even coming. No one had called them or met with them face to face. They had been told by letter. They are only told that they have to move into another site by that same agency. They weren't even told that they could go to a different agency or to an adult foster care, another group home, or supported living. I have a client who was so worried that she thought she was going to have to move to Hillsborough because it was so far. They didn't know that they have options because no one who knows their story is there to explain it to them. I have another client who's lived in the same group home for 5 years, and he has a staff person who he doesn't like. She comes into his home every single day. He should know he doesn't have to deal with that if he doesn't want to. He has the right to move wherever he wants to move or live with his family if he knew that was an option. If their families knew they could get paid for their care, then what kind of options would that open up? Instead, he has lived in 17 foster care homes in over 3 years. These clients have to interview their own foster care homes if they want to move. They have nobody to help them.
Tiffany?
I've just got like 2 cents left. Okay. Someone from the moment they got the letter should have told them, we may not have the answer, but these are your options. You can live at home. You can live in a group home. You can live in foster care. You can live in your own supported living because it's less scary. They need somebody to guide them through the process. Not knowing you have options is the same as not having any.
Thank you very much. And thank you for bringing Josh. It was very important to hear your voice. It was very appropriate to end on that. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2685. I'm going to carry over the work session because I think it's important that you all have the last word on that. On House Bill 2116 and 2221. 2216. I'm carrying over the work session for House Bill 2216, 2221. We'll start with that on Thursday. We're going to knock two bills off because we're always running late. So we're going to, Representative Meek has said that he can hold off on his bill because he's got another one coming that you can hear those two together. And Representative Gomberg has a home ownership repair bill. Those two are going to come off, so we're down to, I believe, three bills. As well as working these two next time. So okay. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you very much.